We got money in climate on the program today. We got money in families. We got money in native tribes. We got a lot going on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today, November the 4th. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. A very quick observation, I guess, about inflation as a way to set things in motion today. When we report on inflation on this program, as we will do next week, Wednesday, when the latest update to the Consumer Price Index comes out, we give you, usually, we try to, we give you two numbers. The headline number, overall inflation, counting a broad basket of goods and services. And then what's called core inflation, which strips out food and energy because those prices tend to bounce around a lot and they can skew the reading, and economists don't like that. But last time I checked, all of us, economists included, use and need food and energy. So that is the inflation we're all feeling. And that is a long way of getting you to this. The United Nations index that measures food prices came out today, up 3% in October to its highest level since 2011. Not terrible news for farmers, right? They're the raw input to those food prices. Unless, of course, you are in a pandemic-induced supply chain nightmare. Marketplace's Caroline Champlin gets us going.
In Northern California, farmer Chris Fedora of Fedora Farms is finishing up the walnut harvest. He usually sells about 80% of the nuts internationally. And this year, he's expecting to have a hard time getting the crop off the farm.
Trucking is going to start becoming a little bit of an issue right now.
Because there aren't enough shipping containers or warehouses for truckers to put the walnuts.
So it's going to start backing up onto us. And then if that's the case, if we're totally full, then if we have anything left in the field, we can't bring it in.
That would be deemed a loss, Fedora says. The problem, besides space, is labor, according to UC Davis agricultural economist Dan Sumner.
Labor to unload the boats and get the trucks and trains moving. And that's everything from truck drivers to port workers and sort of everybody in between.
Normally, over half the walnuts grown in California are exported, often to Asia. But if those nuts can't go overseas, farmers like Chris Fedora may have to sell domestically. That's not ideal, says Tracy Chow with the Western Growers Association.
It can depress prices and it can hurt other farmers who don't export, but they typically don't have to compete with the glut of product that'll be on the market.
It's a frustrating situation for any farmer, says Richard Waycott, CEO of the Almond Board of California. He says foreign shippers are prioritizing stuff that's being sent to the U.S. from Asia.
It's more in their economic interest just to head back with empty containers rather than to take our exports.
But Waycott encourages American consumers to roast some nuts this holiday season because he says prices here will be reasonable. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, kind of a lull, actually, between yesterday's news from the Federal Reserve and the October unemployment report that is coming tomorrow. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'll tell you what, Zillow has turned into something of a saga the past couple of weeks. We told you the other day the company was going to put a pause on buying houses for the rest of the year, in part so it could catch up with a backlog of renovations. This week, Zillow said it is winding down its house flipping business altogether, having not been able to accurately predict where prices have been headed. That failure of prediction cost Zillow more than $400 million last quarter, and so over the next couple of quarters, about 25% of the company's workers are going to lose their jobs. Zillow was just one of several of what are called iBuyers, real estate technology companies that make instant offers on houses. They fix them up a little bit and then sell them off. Marketplace's Amy Scott covers real estate for us, and she dug into what the Zillow news might mean for the iBuyer business model.
When Amanda Riley and Josh Varon started shopping for a house in Portland, Oregon this spring, they saw a red shingled bungalow with two bedrooms and two baths near a park. But the list price, $560,000, felt too big for such a little house in that neighborhood.
And so I kept it as my favorites on my computer, and I was like, I'll come back to it at some point.
She did come back to it a few times, and the price kept dropping.
I think it was like $20,000 down, and then it was like another $10,000, and then I think they dropped it another $10,000, and that's when we were like, okay, that seems a little bit more reasonable.
Now Varen is installing new flooring in the basement. They moved in last month and ended up paying about $520,000, just $300 more than Zillow had paid for it 4 months earlier.
It's just challenging to predict future home prices in such a rapid and volatile market for home price appreciation.
Jeremy Waxman is Zillow's chief operating officer. He says earlier in the year, Zillow underestimated how rapidly home prices would rise and then failed to anticipate the recent return to more gradual increases.
We were undershooting the mark, you know, by 5%+ in one direction. And now we're seeing in some markets we're overshooting the mark.
Meaning they paid too much for houses they now have to sell at a loss.
There's a big question here of Zillow versus iBuying. And I see this as primarily a Zillow problem.
Mike Dilpretti follows the iBuyer market as a scholar in residence at the University of Colorado Boulder. He says while Zillow is also a real estate search and online advertising company with mortgage and title services, competitors like Open Door and OfferPad started out as iBuyers and have stayed focused on that model. They've also been more cautious.
You know, they saw market changes coming earlier this year, and they started slowing down the purchase of homes or not paying quite as much money or increasing their fees. Zillow didn't. Zillow kind of missed the off-ramp.
He says Open Door and OfferPad have been flirting with profitability lately, but home prices aren't going to keep growing, at least at this pace, forever, which means it's going to be harder to make a profit on flipping alone.
So iBuyers are going to have to go back to basics, which is they charge consumers a fee. They try to make money through adjacent services like mortgage and title services. And they kind of get a very, very small margin, but make it up on volume. But we're not there yet.
Volume is growing. Dilpretti says iBuyers made up almost 2% of home purchases in the last quarter, almost double the quarter before that. Of course, that was with Zillow in the mix. Now it's just a seller with, as of September 30th, almost 18,000 houses to unload. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Somewhere close to $30 billion between the CARES Act last year and the American Rescue Plan this past spring. $30 billion or so dollars in virus relief has been distributed to tribal governments. Not entirely smoothly, though. And we've talked about some of the challenges, tribes just being left out, richer tribes getting more than tribes that need the help a bit more. This week, as Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports, researchers at Harvard offered up some possible solutions.
In the early days of the pandemic, it wasn't a given that tribal governments would get any federal aid.
Yeah, this is a really unique and historic investment.
But Kevin Killer, president of the Oglala Sioux Tribe, says the funding has come with challenges, like tight deadlines and allocation formulas that don't account for geographic and economic differences between tribes.
So how do you resolve it? You get more Native people closer to the ground who can understand some of the complexities.
Researchers with Harvard's Project on American Indian Economic Development agree. In a policy paper released this week, they call on the Treasury Department to create a dedicated tribal affairs office.
You need to develop relationships to know how to react to the bumps in the road that really arise.
Eric Henson co-authored that paper. He says Treasury hadn't built those relationships with tribes when Congress charged it with distributing the pandemic aid.
And suddenly made them a major player in an arena that they hadn't really worked in before.
That inexperience led to major missteps, says Twyla Baker. She's president of Nueta Hidatsa Sanish College in North Dakota and an expert on tribal governance. For instance, she says allocation formulas that favored the richest tribes.
We just have to do a better job of serving the people who need it.
Baker supports another of the Harvard Project's recommendations: for the federal government to target the poorest tribes with future aid.
One of the really awful things is the fact that a huge proportion of the population is no longer here to benefit from this.
Baker says a lack of past federal investment in things like healthcare and housing contributed to the high pandemic death toll in tribal communities. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up,
there was $350,000 in there.
Surprise! But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 33 points today, less than a 10%, 36,124 on the blue chips. NASDAQ picked up 128, about 0.8%, 15,940. The S&P 500 added 19, that's in points, 0.4, that's in percent, 46.80. Amy Scott told you about Zillow's failure with house flipping. Zillow's share price rebounded a bit today, advancing 3.5% after falling more than 20% yesterday. Yield on the 10-year T-note, down to 1.52% today. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Out of Glasgow today, this news on the economics and, more accurately, the business model of fighting climate change. The United States and more than 20 other countries said they would stop financing international fossil fuel projects that put any carbon into the atmosphere by the end of next year and redirect that money into clean energy finance. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
This pledge by the U.S., U.K., Canada, and others is the beginning of the end, says Rachel Kite at Tufts University's Fletcher School.
It's the sort of tip of the spear of the exit of public financing from fossil fuels.
The world has been slowly moving away from coal for a while now.
But this is the first time that a number of key countries have come together to say that their public finance cannot be used for the financing of fossil fuels.
And that instead, they'll put that money into clean energy projects abroad.
This is a very big move.
Jake Schmidt is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Every dollar that we're spending overseas on fossil fuels is a dollar that we could be spending on helping these same countries build the clean energy future that's going to solve the climate crisis.
Today's pledge represents about $18 billion a year in funding. And while it's a step in the right direction for the global energy transition, Philip Benoit at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy says it won't be nearly enough.
We need to see increased financing for clean energy projects in developing countries.
Because, he says, new solar and wind projects are often more expensive up front than fossil fuel projects. And
developing countries will continue to need electricity, and in fact will need more electricity to support their poverty alleviation and growth aspirations. At the end of the day, we have a climate imperative, but there is also a development imperative.
And meeting the world's climate goals and development goals, he says, is going to require massive amounts of funding. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
And now for something completely different. Over in the UK, travel restrictions have forced a lot of Brits to vacation at home this year. Hotel rooms have gotten more expensive and they are harder to come by. But a charity over there called the Church's Conservation Trust has come to the rescue with something called champing. camping in a church. It's got capacity, the Church's Trust does. Lots of beautiful old churches that are, well, shall we say, underutilized thanks to a fall in church attendance. So last weekend, Halloween weekend, of course, Marketplace's Stephen Beard went to the village of Edlesborough, 40 or so miles northwest of London, to have a look-see.
Welcome, Stephen. This is 13th century St. Mary the Virgin Church, Edlesborough, Buckinghamshire. Shall we go in?
Let's.
Wyn Johns and fellow volunteers look after the church, which hasn't held regular religious services for decades. Now it's benefiting from a new source of revenue, champing. Visitors pay around $80 a head to bed down here for the night.
It is so atmospheric. There are so many features to see and enjoy.
The stained glass windows, ornate wood carvings, the medieval baptismal font and a 14th century pulpit.
We do encourage people to walk up these steps into the pulpit, and we've got a notice up there, climb up and read aloud. So I'm just going into the pulpit now, and I could just read a verse from the Bible. Love is patient. Love is kind.
Even though this is still a consecrated church, he's relaxed about the champers delivering a more secular text from the pulpit and even letting their hair down in here.
We just have to rely upon their good sense.
But they can have a party here.
Oh, yes, absolutely, yes.
And the building hasn't suffered.
No, it hasn't. Well, it's benefited because of the money and the profile.
No more than 8 champers can stay each night. Camp beds are provided, and hot water bottles too, essential at this time of year since there's no heating, and it can get pretty chilly in here.
Bit spooky too, one imagines, especially at Halloween.
And especially as we do have bats in here.
Oh, really?
Yes.
But that doesn't seem to put the champers off.
Well, no, it's all part of the experience.
And just arriving for the chills and thrills of a night in the church, a pair of champers.
That's amazing.
Lisa Eharike and her partner, Gareth Bannister.
Just an interesting sort of weekend away, an escape from London, if you will, in the countryside, you know. It's a nice pub nearby. Plenty of things to keep us interested, I think, for the evening.
The young couple are not the least perturbed at the prospect of an eerie experience. Quite the reverse.
That's the intention, and we've got some horror movies to watch as well.
You're going to scare yourselves to death.
Yeah, that's the intention. Well, we'll see.
I didn't have the heart to tell her about the bats.
Can we come back tomorrow morning to see whether you've survived your night in a cold, empty church?
Yes, definitely. Why not?
Champing has proved very popular this year. Guy Foreman of the Church's Conservation Trust says they've had their busiest ever season, serving more than 1,500 champers.
The interest in the concept has been extremely high this year for lots of different reasons.
The pandemic forcing people to vacation at home, for example. Meanwhile, back at St. Mary the Virgin, the morning after the night before, I return to check up on the champers.
Hello, Gareth and Lisa.
Hello.
Well, how did it go?
Yeah, very good.
Got a bit of a leak in the roof here, but...
It was totally fine.
They didn't encounter any bats and found the ambience in the middle of the night only mildly unnerving.
I mean, I heard a few small noises. I wasn't sure if it could be a church mice, but I heard a few things.
Creaking in the
night. Yes, creaking, yeah.
No regrets. You had a good time.
It was fantastic, yeah. Yeah, definitely we'll do it again, yeah.
For the vacationers and the church conservationists, champing has proved a godsend. At St. Mary the Virgin in Edlesborough, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
When the economic divisions in this country come up, whether in political debate or policy discussions or what have you, income inequality is the thing that gets most of the attention, as to some degree is to be expected. It's right there, literally in people's paychecks every couple of weeks. But the wealth gap in this country is bigger and growing faster, in part because it's a generational thing. Families pass down their fortunes. But what happens when somebody in the family tree interrupts that pattern? Rima Kreis, the host of our podcast, This Is Uncomfortable, brings us this story.
Morgan Curtis discovered she had hundreds of thousands of dollars to her name, pretty much by accident. She was in college, and the used car her dad had given her finally broke down.
And I sold it for $1,500 and asked my dad, like, hey, where should I put this money? Because I knew it was his. And he was like, you can keep it, but only if you invest it in the stock market.
Morgan figured if those were her dad's terms, then she'd invest in renewable energy. She was a big climate activist on campus. She even pressured the school to divest from fossil fuels. So one day after class, alone in her apartment, she opened up her laptop.
I opened myself a brokerage account. My dad taught me how to do that.
She entered her name, her social security number.
And when I logged into the account for the first time and opened it up, there was $350,000 in there.
And you had no idea?
I had no idea. And as I look through it, it's invested in Chevron, Exxon, all the same corporations that I had been fighting and organizing against.
Turns out her dad had invested that money as a future college fund when she was little, but he never really told her the details. She'd always known that her family was incredibly wealthy, but she didn't know that she was in possession of a piece of the family pie. And then, do you remember one of the first conversations you had with your dad about what you wanted to do?
I remember telling him that I wanted to give it all away.
Literally, all of her money. But even though that's what she wanted to do, she couldn't. Her dad, John Curtis, was still in control of the account, and he was not thrilled about Morgan's idea.
Morgan has turned on its head the whole relationship with money that I grew up with. It's turned it upside down.
John had grown up being taught that the family wealth was a kind of stewardship, that he had a duty to shepherd it from one generation to the next. But Morgan didn't like what the money represented about their family legacy and how they'd acquired their wealth. Like, her great-great-great-uncle had been the director of a gold mine in Honduras, which would end up leading to things like deforestation and water pollution. Another one of her ancestors, who'd been the captain of a ship on Boston Harbor, was a slave owner.
I just became increasingly clear of, like, I don't want this money. I don't need this money. Like, I already have so many privileges in this lifetime. And so if there's something better, even healing, that this money could get up to, that's what I want to do.
Several years passed before Morgan finally gained full control of the account. Now she technically doesn't need her dad's permission to move money around. She didn't know where to start, so she joined Resource Generation. It's this national organization of young folks from the richest 10% of families in the U.S. who want to redistribute their wealth. Right now, there are more than 1,200 members, and it's growing. With their help, she's donated about $260,000 to date. She's mostly donated to climate justice groups and indigenous and black-led organizations. Her dad still worries she's making a mistake.
You don't know what responsibilities are coming your direction, and you are getting rid of your rainy day money before you're even 30.
But there is a lot of overlap between what Morgan cares about and what John cares about. Like, they're both committed to protecting the environment and divesting from fossil fuels. There's still this impasse, though, where Morgan condemns their money and John doesn't. When I sat down with the two of them to talk it out, John told Morgan that he wants them to honor their family legacy, not feel ashamed of it.
I feel a lot of responsibility looking at that family tree to try to, do something of import to, continue some legacy. You feel responsibility is just a different one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely similarly feel a lot of responsibility. And I guess what I see is it's the beginning of a story of our family no longer standing with some of the status quo around wealth hoarding. It's the beginning of our family being like, oh, we want to be part of building a more just world.
For Morgan and John, this isn't just a question over what to do with their money. It's a question about stories. What story they each choose to tell about their family, and who will continue telling it in the future. I'm Rima Khreis for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which the mayor of Miami, Francis Suarez, and Eric Adams, the mayor-elect of New York City, are trying to one-up each other, and you just kind of know it's not going to end well. Suarez, who's been trying to turn Miami into a tech hub, said Tuesday on Twitter, before he was reelected, that he's going to take his next paycheck in Bitcoin. Adams said on Twitter today he's going to take his first three paychecks in Bitcoin once he is sworn in January. I guess, I mean, I don't know, but I guess they're kind of bullish on crypto, right? Okay, out of here we are, but here's your moment of economic context. I maybe ought to, probably should have put this a bit higher up in the show, but the weekly report on new claims for unemployment benefits came in today at just under 269,000. Just, I mean, yes, it's a lot of people losing their jobs, but honestly, it's not far at all from where we were in the before times, and that is a good thing. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, and Diantha Parker are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.